For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. And, Tim, we got a special guest.
We do. Dr. Gwen Adams is back. Welcome back, Dr.
Thanks
Adams.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be back.
Well, today, Kent, what are we going to talk about?
Well, you've heard the term, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Yes. Is it?
I don't know about that.
I don't know if it's true.
You say something like that and all the cave men go, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
No, we're going to talk today a little bit about aesthetics, the study of beauty, the study of art. And particularly, we're going to talk a little bit about how art plays within our Catholic lives, how as Catholics, beauty isn't something that we should just kind of ignore. And it's not just sort of something we set off to the side.
Mm-hmm.
Or take for granted.
No, I do think it's very personal. I mean, if you start talking about music, people get really kind of passionate because it just, more than truth or a principle, it just cuts right to who you think you are and what you care about. But I don't think that you could just reduce it to.
Right. That's one of the big contradictions about art and aesthetics is that on the one hand, it's subjective. You know, it affects all of us differently. We all react differently to beauty, etc. But on the other hand, there's a sort of objective quality that we all want to claim. So, you know, if I go and tell you that this was a great movie and you say, no, that movie wasn't so good, we're going to argue about it and we're going to have a discussion about it. And we're as if there was some objective criteria out there that would make this a good movie or a bad movie.
Well, even that in and of itself, that there that might even be under dispute, right? I mean, people may often, when it comes to discussing art or aesthetics, there's a radical subjectivity to it, right? Dr. Gwen, you're just talking about how personal it is.
Yeah.
It seems very difficult to move into the realm of objectivity and objective, say, standards, because it's like, well, it's we often, I think, reduce art to preference, or Aquinas might say, like taste, right? It's a matter of taste. You like raspberry ice cream. I kind of favor chocolate. And Mark, he likes Rocky Road, the Hegelian that he is.
You just brought that in.
You got to listen. You got to listen to the game frequently to know what that's
no,
all
no,
about.
No. Rocky Road is very Hegelian.
Okay. So what do we mean? So we talk about the subjective. So it sounds like there would be an objective and a subjective element to art. And the subjective piece often tickles our feelings, right? We have a kind of emotional response to art, right? Which is, because art is evocative, right?
Right.
It evokes, a good art should evoke, or not only good art, but also there's a certain set of dispositions the human person ought to have such that good art is evocative of us, that it would cultivate. I mean, wouldn't you say? So let me take an example. So let's talk about, say, often Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. When we think about masterpieces, it's often held up as one. And so, what would you say, Dr. Gwen, about someone who? What's going on if I fail to appreciate Beethoven's Ninth Symphony? What is there? On a subjective level, what do you think's happening there?
Well, I hope we spend some time talking. I am actually not very familiar at all with this idea of transcendentals, but I remember getting into an argument with somebody about beauty sort of reflects something about God, and the other person completely disagreed with that. It was very subjective. It's just, if I think this is beautiful.
Well, if I listen to Eminem, I have trouble finding God in that.
Right. Well, that's what I was sort of like.
But there's a cheap shot on me, so I don't know.
Yeah, that's what you would argue about.
Well,
is like
even Beethoven's Ninth. You know, mm-hmm. some people would say, you know, well, it's not a liturgical piece. It's not a Christian piece. You know, a lot mm-hmm. of Mozart's music was mm-hmm. made as mm-hmm. Christian music,
or
around
Bach.
The Mass, or mm-hmm. Bach, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But Beethoven wasn't. So you know, therefore, yeah, what does it have to do with God? Because it wasn't made, you know, for the purpose of worshiping God.
Mm-hmm. So, but if it is completely subjective, then there's no argument. Then it's like what you said about taste. But then I couldn't get any farther, because he just would not agree that there's anything that beauty is connected to anything outside of oneself. So, but then I can't really go much farther in this area of, I mean,
right.
maybe you could bring in a little bit of that.
You know, and I mean, that's an old idea that, mm-hmm. that beauty is one of the three transcendentals. You know, there's truth, there's goodness,
okay.
and there's beauty. And all of these are convertible with being. In other words, they're all kind of aspects of being, or I guess manifestation might be the best word, of being that we see and appreciate. And of course, when you're talking about God, we mm-hmm. understand that God is being. God is okay. that entity that acts, and he is his own being, and he
his
just,
essence is his existence.
As it
right.
says in the Bible, I am. So
yeah, right.
So to that extent, you know, beauty and our reaction to beauty is and can be very much a religious experience and a way to appreciate God and get to God. I think most people, this experience comes when you're out in nature. And you're out among the trees, and mm-hmm. you're in the woods, and your appreciation of the beauty of nature lifts your spirit up. And most people experience this as a religious experience. This is drawing closer to God. But nonetheless, that mm-hmm. awe, that sense of overwhelming just okay. appreciation of beauty.
Yeah.
Is like I said, most people experience that as a religious experience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why, when you go to the art museum and you see, you know, a portrait there of some 19th century gentleman, do we not feel that same sense of awe in the presence of a beautiful object mm-hmm. that we've created? That's a whole other question. And mm-hmm. how far or remote and to what extent is a piece of artwork trying to represent something beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
That's all. Yeah, I think that's where we start to get into the question of there's something more going on in art than just depiction mm-hmm. of beauty.
Okay.
I think part of what might be helpful too is if we go back to Aristotle and his four causes. So remember, Aristotle talks about the four causes as being the material cause, the efficient cause, the formal cause, and the final cause. And I've heard it said before that one of the deprivations that's occurring with modern and postmodern art is that there's a lack of formal or final causality.
Lack of meaning?
Well, the meaning is... So things are formless, so they mm-hmm. no longer correspond to, say, the forms that we find in nature.
I see. Okay.
So you could think of like a Picasso, for example, might be an example of that. There's and formal and final cause in inanimate objects are often contiguous with one another. So the purpose for which I think you're talking about, for which it's made, also becomes very ambiguous at best. And there's a hyper... sensationalization of the material and efficient causes. By that I mean the material cause. In other words, what's this thing made of? So what, you know, colors and shapes and things that don't correspond to the natural world or are intentionally provocative thereof or abstractions thereof. And then on the efficient cause, well, what's the efficient cause of art? Well, it's the human person. So it's a hyper... It's a way in which I can, in a hyper radical sense, express myself. So art has become in the contemporary setting it's simply a subjective expression of myself as the maker of the art,
mm-hmm.
and it can have zero correspondence to, or maybe stand in contrast to, or maybe even violate nature in what it's attempting to show you.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is why you can go into, as you walk through, say, like Indiana Museum of Art, for example, Indianapolis Museum of Art, the IMA, a few years ago they had, it was quite remarkable, they had showcased a sacred art exhibit, sacred art from Spain, from the 17th century, and it was absolutely fantastic. It had lots of images of Our Lady and of the Immaculate Conception, which wasn't dogma yet, but it was emerging and things like that. And so I went through this tour of the sacred art from Spain, and it was absolutely magnificent. And it was all these, it was portraits, and it was landscape, and it was the sacred art. And then immediately, just by crossing a threshold into the next room, I found myself completely pixelated a very modern set of exhibits, I couldn't make, again, Picasso, I'll go to Picasso, because his artwork, from my perspective, fails on the formal and final causality. And someone listening might contact the show and say, well, Tim, that's you. But I would say there was something very, something drastically different between what's going on in a contemporary, modern or postmodern setting with art versus, say, sacred art as we've understood it.
I was reading this book by Tom Wolfe, Bonfire of the Vanities. He actually wrote a book about modern art, and he said something that was really interesting about that sort of movement in modern art that's Andy Warhol, like the Campbell's soup cans. And goes,
yeah, Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, people didn't go for that art wildly because it was poking fun at the establishment or because Andy Warhol was a rock star like Jackson Pollock was before him. He says people crave like images that are like life. They crave images that are understandable and are recognizable. And it's like, it wasn't because it was taking a stand. It was because it looked like a Campbell's soup can, and people were like, "Oh, I know what that is."
I got some of that at home.
And not only that, it brings back the memories that you have of Campbell's soup. You know, coming home from school, mom pulling out the can of Campbell's soup, and it brings back all of the emotions and everything that goes with it. You know, your reference back to final and formal causality, and that being kind of a big difference between modern and contemporary art and all of that, I think is crucial because modern art in a lot of ways has become recreational because of that. So it's the purpose of it now is purposelessness, and so it's art for art's sake, which was Andy Warhol's mantra. But part of that is that you've got the material, you've got sort of the creation of it. And the appreciation of it is a game. It's recreation. This is an object that you're kind of mentally playing with, kind of trying to figure out what it is, trying to figure out how the colors fit together, trying to figure out what the artist was doing when he created. And it turns, it turns the aesthetic experience of this object into something that's much more play-like, I think, than when we approach something where we kind of have a final we recognize this as something that is trying to go deeper than just the appearance of it.
Mm-hmm. We need to take a short break, and we'll be back with more on aesthetics right after this.
Anytime you get in the car, turn on the radio, you know that there's going to be something encouraging.
It's such an encouragement and enriching to my own Christian walk.
It brings me a great deal of peace.
I really am blessed whenever I listen.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blandford, and our special guest, Dr. Gwen Adams, and we are talking about aesthetics. We're talking about beauty. And we were talking about how, where modern art has gone, it has made art to where there's a playful purposelessness to it, to where when you engage with it, it's much more of a recreational, playful type of engagement rather than something serious. And when we're talking about art in the Mass, when we're talking about art as a liturgical form, or when we're talking about creating art as sacred art, it's definitely a lot more than just playfulness there. We're doing a lot more with beauty than just sort of playing with it when we're using it for religious purposes.
Yeah. I was thinking about what you were saying earlier about, when you go into the museum and you see something and it kind of leaves you cold, this piece, like cubism or something, and you
The big red cube.
Yeah. You know, and you think.
Clutching my Chardonnay, looking at it, going, what is that thing?
And you feel like you're supposed to respond, but you just
I'm
don't.
Hiding that, though, because I don't know how to respond.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, I don't want to look cool. Oh, I'm feeling really awkward. And we were saying earlier, it's not subjective. It's not just in the eye of the beholder. It reflects something about God. But then I think that means that your soul is kind of, since our souls are made for God, there should be a kind of natural responsiveness to it. There should be something going on in you if you're really in front of something that has beauty in it.
Yeah, I think when we are in front of something that truly has beauty, we recognize there's to a certain extent a soul within it. You know, if you see a beautiful depiction of the Madonna, you're seeing more than just paint on canvas. Yeah. You're seeing the beauty of her. You're seeing the beauty of her soul to a certain extent through that depiction on the canvas. I mean, that's why we have portraiture or pictures in our homes of our loved ones, not because this is a great depiction of them. No, it's because through that painting we have access to sort of a spiritual contact with them to a small extent.
Yeah, but I do have a friend who thought, well, she and I kind of have this conversation, especially about liturgical beauty, like a really beautiful hymn or a beautiful church. And she said, I used to think if you just put beautiful things in front of people, they'd just get it. They respond. And she says, but I don't think a lot of people do anymore. They don't know how to respond. And she didn't know what to do with that. But it didn't remind me. I came to think about this more. I was reading about an Auschwitz survivor, Viktor Frankl. He's a psychologist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of him, yeah.
Yeah, he's really... And he tells a story kind of about how the ability to notice beauty got drummed out of them. The first day they were freed from the camps, they went and took a walk, and they went through a field. It was a meadow full of flowers, and it was a blue sky, and the sun was shining. And a bird came by with really beautiful feathers, and they all saw it. But when they went back that night, somebody started the conversation. It was really awkward. They said, I didn't feel a thing. Did you? No, I didn't either. I couldn't respond at all. And he said, we had to relearn to appreciate beauty. And you could think about that forever. Natural responsiveness to beauty had been drummed out of them by being, treated subhumanly, by suffering, by being worked to death, And I think that would do it to you. And we kind of have they're not like the camps, but we have things in our culture being treated like a tool, overwork, distraction. I think that probably,
Yeah, aesthetic appreciation is something that you have to kind of develop over time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the engagement of your imagination with the engagement of your intellect, with the engagement of your will. I mean, there's a whole... You bring your whole soul, I think, to a piece of artwork, and in some ways, it's similar to what we bring to Mass. I mean, our engagement with a piece of art is the same way, to a certain extent, that we engage with the Mass, and in a lot of ways, our experience of Mass is an aesthetic experience.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that comes from our background. How are we approaching this? For example, if you walk into a museum and you see a beautiful painting of a Madonna, you know the story behind that. You know who this person is. You know the story of Mary. You know the story of Jesus. But if you walk into the next gallery and there's a picture of, Frank Smith, and you look at that and you think, okay, nice painting. They did a good job. It looks realistic. But there's no story. There's no connection behind it. Many times when we find ourselves at Mass, we don't connect to the Mass.
Yeah.
And it's the beauty of the Mass that should draw us into that. We are so busy. When we walk into Mass, it's like, okay, I hope he doesn't take more than an hour because I've got such and such to do after this. We don't take the time to put the world aside and connect to the beauty that is right there in the language of the Mass, the music of the Mass, just the lyrical feeling of being part of this community.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we were talking a little bit about, I think in what we're getting at in part is around this idea of formation, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have to be schooled, we have to be educated, so that we create the kind of dispositions that open us up to authentic appreciation of aesthetic experiences.
Yeah.
I mean, one contrast might be, if it's a beautiful sunset and you're you know, you're with someone, say, you know, and you care about, and you say, hey, what do you think of the sunset? Isn't it beautiful? And they go, eh. You're like, what's wrong with that person?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And you realize that there's something lacking in their formation, right? There's something lacking about their dispositions. And maybe it was never there, or maybe it was there and drummed out of them, or maybe there's something that's going on. But I think part of what we have to do, and what you were talking about, Ken, is especially as it comes to appreciating the aesthetic qualities of the masses, we have to know the mass in order to love the mass. So we want to, just as we might take an art appreciation class or other studies to study music, to open ourselves up to and create the dispositions and appreciation by knowing more about it, we ought to be doing the same thing with our faith. We should be learning more about what's going on with the mass.
Well, you know, and it's one of those things. Unfortunately, the mass, because it is a liturgy, because it is a structured form, becomes somewhat repetitious to us. And how many people, I mean, honestly, I will readily admit to this, I can stand there in mass and recite the entire creed along with everyone else and have 100 other things on my mind at the same time.
Okay, but, cut his mic, Mark.
Right.
Get out. Yeah. Nobody else ever experiences
that. No one gets distracted at mass. That's really foreign, Kent.
Your lips keep moving and the sound keeps coming out, but you know, you're saying, you're reciting the prayer, but are you truly praying?
Yeah.
Have you missed the beauty of the words that you're saying?
But on the other hand, we all have favorite songs that we can't listen to enough. You know, we hear it on the radio. We know
Kumbaya,
the words.
My
that
Lord.
Would not be one of them.
Wait. What's the other one? Dominique. Oh, no. The Singing Nun. Yeah. 1963 Grammy Award winner.
Oh, no.
Anyway.
See, you knew I was going to work that in.
We all have favorite music. If you're normal, it's usually good music. If you're Tim, well, maybe not. But
I'm a work in progress, as they say. Yes, I'm not finished, Mark.
But anyway, our experience that you're talking about with the mass of being so overly familiar that, you know, the words, you know, just come to us by rote, you know, we you know, go right through it. You can describe that same experience of your favorite song as you hear it on the radio. You know, you're sitting in the car at the same time, the same place, in the exact way, the same words are coming out of the radio. You're singing along, and they're just going along over and over and over, and yet it never gets old. You know, this is something that you find beautiful or appealing, and so there is no banality to it. And yet you're right to a certain extent about the mass. The mass isn't quite that way for us yet.
Yeah, I think it comes down to the difference of giving your attention and your time to it, because the song that you love to hear, that comes on and you give yourself to the experience. Whereas if you're saying the creed and you're not sort of there to receive it, well, then you are like, oh, it's time for brunch. Yay. Where did that mass go? You know,
and I think a lot of that comes back to what we were talking about earlier. What's your story behind that?
Right.
Have you just learned the creed by rote, or has someone actually taken that creed apart for you and explained every single section? I remember the first time someone did that for me, took the creed and, you know, went through line by line and told me what it means, what's the history, what's behind this. Then all of a sudden, the next time I recited it, I wasn't just mouthing the words. All of a sudden, it became alive.
Oh, cool.
There was a beauty to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of like somebody having to walk you through Homer or Shakespeare or any other great work of art like that. Then, unless you have somebody that can teach it to you,
a guide, a trustworthy guide,
you have to become cultured. I mean, there's that term being a cultured person. I think explains a lot when it comes to being properly disposed to beautiful works of art, and also being properly disposed to the mass.
Yeah. Now, I would say, though, that it kind of builds, because as you become receptive to beauty, you can you just become more receptive. I'm thinking of the conversion story of Bishop James Conley out in Lincoln, Nebraska. I don't know if you guys, his story is so interesting.
I know of him, but I don't know the story.
Okay, so he was in a program at the University of Kansas called the Integrated Humanities Program, where their teachers thought, you know, these guys don't have any experiences of beautiful things. So they would take them out on trips, and they took them to Ireland, and they would read poems with them and great novels. And they took them to France, kind of like just a tour, and they went to Fauconbeau Monastery. Now, James Connolly was not, at that time, any kind of Catholic. But, you know, like these repeated experiences, he'd never really been to a mass before. And he went to mass at the monastery of Fauconbeau and at the elevation of the Eucharist. Mm. It just changed his life. He said, that is God. And was so beautiful. And you think, so that's a guy who did not really understand mass, but he had a lot of prep so that when that beautiful moment came, it didn't leave him cold.
He was disposed to it.
It changed his life. Yeah.
Right,
and
right.
So
I'm
not disagreeing about the understanding. That really builds your awareness of beauty. But then it also leaves you open for later experiences where that might just happen in a flash. It's really amazing.
Yeah, beauty has a way of sometimes just hitting you like that and just smacking you. And you're right. To a certain extent, that experience, you don't need to be a cultured person necessarily to have that experience. You don't need to.
It builds. Yeah.
It builds over time. But yeah, I mean, there's other conversion stories. You know, people who've been converted just by going to some of the great Gothic cathedrals that are in Europe, these huge monuments that have been made to the glory of God, and just being struck by the beauty. People have converted just based off of that.
It's cool.
Well, what about, we've talked about the arts. We haven't necessarily talked about, say, great literature and finding beauty in great literature. What role do you think, Dr. Gwen Adams, you're a big reader.
Oh,
I know that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So where do you find beauty in literature?
Ooh, like specific books I've read, or how does it?
Yes.
We could go either way.
Yes.
I would say my top three books would be Lord of the Rings, Brideshead Revisited, and The Brothers Karamazov. Those are all.
Are you single? Because I am. I think I just fell in love.
and all three
those
of those.
Those are three great books. I love those.
Yeah.
All three of those are great Catholic works of literature.
Yeah.
And so we're coming up on another break here, so we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about what makes a work of literature Catholic versus what makes it
and beautiful.
Secular and beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
So, the scan button brought you here. Awesome. We like company. Get to know us. And if you have to leave, come back. You're always welcome. Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. Once again, I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, our special guest, Dr. Gwen Adams, and we are talking about aesthetics, we're talking about aesthetic experiences, we're talking about beautiful objects, we were just about to start talking about beautiful novels, but before we go there, I want to talk a little bit about why is this appreciation of beauty an important part of being Catholic? Why is this something that we as Catholics should aspire towards as part of being Catholic and not just, appreciating beauty, it's a nice thing, it's a good thing to do, but really, you can be a wonderful person, you can be a great person, you can be a saint, but you really don't need to cultivate an appreciation of beauty to do all of that.
Yeah, it can feel like an extra, but I think it gives us an experience of what our relationship with God is really supposed to be like. There's something about truth and goodness that feel like I have rules to follow. There's things I need to do. There's tasks. There's works of mercy. There's just all this stuff to do. But that's not really what heaven and our relationship with God is supposed to be about. And there's something about when you see a sunrise, there's nothing you are expected to do except to just receive it, just to be with it. And that's kind of, it's sort of like God set it up so that we have a lot of experiences of practicing just being with him, with no expectations or rules or, you know, tasks. We're so functional these days, you know. It's just,
and it seems like, I'm so glad you brought that up, Dr. M. It seems like those are treasured moments where there's a kind of receptivity of our souls without the call to reciprocity. And in sort of bathing in the beauty and graces that God has created. And it does really deep, moving aesthetic experiences mm-hmm. are kind of a foretaste of heaven, right? Yeah, I mean, yeah. it is. They can be a very tangible, palpable way, because I think it's also a way. Beauty also, it also connects us to love, right? To yeah. loving things yeah. and loving people in an authentic Catholic way,
mm-hmm. right? You know, when you're in the presence of something beautiful, you often describe that as, oh, I was in heaven, or oh, I was heavenly.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, there is something even natural to connect mm-hmm. us to appreciation of beauty and the beatific vision, mm-hmm. the being in the presence of God and the being in the presence of something beautiful. We see something synonymous there between the two. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, when we appreciate something, we do kind of have that foretaste of heaven going on
yeah.
when we appreciate something beautiful. But not all beauty is that way, right? I mean, there are some things that are beautiful, but they're beautiful in an ugly sort of way.
You're talking about what we were talking earlier about, Benedict XVI had said about the crucifix.
Right, the crucifix.
It's the most beautiful thing there is, right. Although technically it's a grotesque, horrible image, yet because of what Christ has done for us, it's the most beautiful thing there is. That's kind of paradoxical.
Right, yeah, there's paradox. The movie Life is Beautiful.
The
dad mm-hmm. and his little boy mm-hmm. in a Nazi concentration camp. That's mm-hmm. another thing. I mean, this is a horrible situation. The movie is ugly, mm-hmm. but it's beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful films out there, but yeah. it's depicting a reality that's about as ugly as you can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there are many ways that we can gain these aesthetic experiences. So you had mentioned, and I brought this up around literature, you had mentioned yeah. three of your favorite works of literature. So we've talked about paintings, we've talked about mm-hmm. music, we've talked about sacred art. What are some of the, and we talked a little bit about literature, what are other ways, why is it important? Well, let me ask two things. What are some other ways that we can gain aesthetic experiences, but maybe more deeply, why is it in our best interest to cultivate the kind of dispositions and engage in the types of activities that put us in contact with aesthetic experiences?
You know, and it brings up another great contradiction, mm-hmm. is some of the most cultured, aesthetically aware people are some of the worst people on the face of the earth.
Yeah, because you don't want it to be like being a gourmet and just like seeking after nice experiences.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there's something.
Oh, foodie? Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm not necessarily talking about foodie. I'm talking about, I mean, like the Nazis to a certain extent. We keep going back to the Nazis
they
in this discussion.
All this art.
But they were
yeah.
great collectors of art. Yeah. They had huge appreciations of beauty. Mm-hmm. They were stirred and moved by the.
That was another great movie,
Wagner.
Monument Men.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah. But yet, once again, I mean, mm-hmm. morally, these yeah. people were monsters.
Reprehensible.
But they had that aesthetic. So there's not a direct one-to-one correlation there. If you cultivate a cultured disposition towards art, it does not automatically make you a moral good person.
Right.
But yeah. yet, we do tend to think that way. We do tend to think that somebody who's cultured is better than somebody who isn't.
Well, I think that points to something I think it was Chesterton pointed out, which is that we have to cultivate all the virtues mm-hmm. kind of together and not just have one and be lacking in other categories because it's insufficient. So we began the show kind of talking a little bit about the three transcendentals mm-hmm. of the good, the true, and the beautiful. The beautiful alone, so saying a deep appreciation for cultural aesthetics. Mm-hmm. Without being a good person or appreciation for
right.
what's true
yeah. mm-hmm.
can mean you can be quite villainous perhaps
yeah.
right.
and you know love so. Palestrina
yeah so those things would temper it, you know, because you see
yeah,
like
yeah,
in that
yeah.
art collecting there's not yeah. receptivity, there's tons of possessiveness and control and you
oh,
know the,
yes,
yeah
yes.
and
yes.
whereas you know a life of prayer and a pursuit of virtue and understanding the truth would really have kind of transformed was just sort of like being an Epicurean and kind of like just like piling up like treats. That's, you know, that's not at all what beauty is really for.
So. That's very animalistic, right? You made me think of my lab at home who would like nothing better than to pile up treats.
Right. Okay. Well, let's get back to novels and, you know, art that I think the great thing about novels is everybody recognizes that the good literature is something that's good for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit harder when you start talking about, you know, the ballet or opera as something, well, you know, that's something that's good for you. We can easily, readily see that reading good literature is something that's good for you.
Although Puccini's operas, I have to admit, are quite delightful for the soul.
Oh, yeah. And you know, Tchaikovsky's ballets, same thing. I mean, beautiful, beautiful ballets. But anyway, going back to what is it about a good novel that is important for the spiritual life, or I guess a good ballet or a good opera? What is it that makes this an intricate part of being a good Catholic?
I think some of the things we've been saying before, that those experiences of receptivity, I guess that just feeds right into, you know, if it's tempered, like we said, with truth and goodness, that it feeds right into the ability to pray, I think. I was, I listed some books earlier, but I was thinking actually a better book to read might be Surprised by Joy, C.S. Lewis's. That is his story of how beautiful experiences with, not just by themselves, really led him to prayer and to God. And that really lays it out what that connection was.
I'm pretty sure C.S. Lewis was an anonymous Catholic. That's another debate. Okay, that's my claim. Okay, I'm going to claim that.
Nonetheless,
feel free to disagree.
Nonetheless,
he's worth reading.
Exactly, always, he was a very good Christian gentleman. Yes. No doubt about that. And by gentleman, that implies a certain amount of culture and aesthetic appreciation behind that. I think when we're in the presence of something beautiful, whether it's a beautiful novel or a beautiful artwork, our imagination engages with it, and our intellect engages with it in a way that there's something sanctifying about it. There's something that when you're there in the presence of something that's been made for holy purposes, when we receive it in our imagination, it helps to kind of cleanse our imaginations and clean out our imaginations and sanctify it, which in today's day and age is so important because our imaginations are filled with just such utter drivel on a day-to-day basis.
I love that word, drivel.
I could have picked other words.
Culturally
so apropos. Good for the kids. So
there's almost an antidote to contemporary, modern, daily life that we encounter when we encounter something beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, going back to I love the story that you shared, Dr. Gwen, around Viktor Frankl's experience or lack of ability to appreciate beauty, because there is, on one hand, we want to go down the track of putting ourselves in a position to have aesthetic experiences and creating the dispositions. At the same time, we need to, I think, avoid, there's much in the culture that we ought to be avoiding or saying no to, because it will drum out, as you say, will drum out our ability to appropriately receive the graces that come through authentic aesthetic experiences.
So it's always worth talking about and arguing about, is this really beautiful or not? Is this actually helping?
And with
me,
that, the show's over. Yeah. No.
Nope.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. That's, that is, and I like that you brought that up, because we so often, because it seems so subjective, it seems that question is bankrupt, right? Without a better understanding of what we mean by aesthetics and its importance.
Right. Or we let people tell us what's supposed to be beautiful,
the pressure. Right. Right. The pressure of the Chardonnay clutch at the Metropolitan, looking at the red cube
everywhere.
What is that thing?
Yeah, it's museums and fashion, and it's just and music and everything. I'm supposed to like this, instead of saying, wait a second, what's going on in here?
Right.
So. Yeah.
You know, it all brings to mind, I finished a religious retreat once, and the retreat master kind of laid out the challenge of, okay, now going forth, you know, I think at the end of every retreat, you get to a point where they're saying, okay, the retreat's over now. Your job is to try to continue this experience beyond just the retreat. But part of his challenge to do that was to switch your radio listening habits. That was his challenge. Pretty simple and mundane. Instead of listening to sports radio, or instead of listening to talk radio, or instead of listening to secular music, turn it to one of the Christian music stations.
And like Catholic Radio Indy, 89.1 and 90.9 FM.
Right, exactly. And
shameless plug.
But yeah, but you know, I'm just sort of that daily, you know, the daily drive, listen to Christian music for a while. And notice if it changes. And so, you know, I took him up on the challenge for a little while. I personally, a whole another show topic, but a lot of contemporary Christian music I do not find particularly beautiful. But
if only there were a Catholic
I know we
music
need somebody
program
to be able to guide us through what is
that had like
good
a jukebox format. That would be fun.
Yeah, maybe you could call it the Catholic jukebox.
We could
be more specific and bring it down to Catholic Jukebox Indiana, Catholic Radio Indy, Saturday and Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. hosted by some guy.
The Blanford.
But anyway, after a little while of doing that, I did notice a change. Mm-hmm. And I did notice that, you know, even listening.
A change in you?
A change in me.
Okay.
Yes. Really? Yes. A change in me, a change in my just, I think, to a certain extent, appreciation of God.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily an appreciation of the music, but an appreciation of God
goal.
Just because of being surrounded by music that was made for the purpose of glorifying God and bringing forward a truly Christian aesthetic experience.
Mm-hmm. And we need to take a short break right here. We'll be back with more on the Catholic Cave right after this. You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. We're having a ridiculous amount of fun talking about aesthetics here with Kent Blanford, our trusty sidekick and producer, Mark Tuttle, our special guest, Dr. Gwen Adams. And I want to bring up the ugly side of things, which is sometimes I've been to a mass that I got to admit was not that beautiful. It feels like it was deformed, and by that I mean a lack of, there's a form to the mass and there was something lacking there, so it was a sort of a deformation of it.
Yeah, and masses aren't the only thing that we can look at and sit there and go, oh, you know, that was kind of ugly, that didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, part of the aesthetic experience is realizing when something is not aesthetically pleasing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we do have that experience with the Mass. It brings up the question, is the Mass an aesthetic experience? You know, when we go to Mass and we're there worshiping and we're in it, we're not just going through the motions, but we're really engaged, is this an encounter with beauty? Is this supposed to be something that we are responding to aesthetically?
Yeah.
Or is our response supposed to be something else?
No, I think it is. And there's, you know, when you've been at a mass where you thought, oh, I don't know about this. It's interesting to see. So what was wrong? One thing we see in some of the church documents, or I'm thinking Ratzinger, Spirit of the Liturgy, is a lot of it becoming performance and self-expression. There's a lot he writes about that. And I, of course, was thinking like, oh, yeah, right now we've all been there where like somebody thinks that they're going to be the next star on Glee or something. And you think like, oh, it's so awkward.
That zoots.
But
he
was actually talking about it was a huge problem around the Council of Trent. People just sort of becoming opera, rock kind of stars. And he's like, that is not what it's for. It's not about you. And that's always a temptation, I think, not just in the Mass, but in probably any kind of performance kind of thing, a play, an opera. You know.
Yeah, there's as an actor, as a performer, and you know, therefore, as a liturgist, as somebody that's part of the liturgy, you have to submit yourself. There's a submission that goes on to the form, to the art that is above and beyond you. And that's part of the beauty of the Mass, is this is sort of the ultimate form that's above and beyond.
A humility
And even those of us that are in the laity, you know, we are supposed to be participating in the Mass. Mm-hmm. And that participation is a type of submission to this ultimate godly form that's coming across.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think of like the great actor Ian McKellen and his... he plays a variety of different roles, but when I think of what makes him a great Shakespearean actor, isn't that he changes Shakespeare? Mm-hmm. It's that he pours himself into the role,
right?
Oh,
and that's where I think when I think of very beautiful masses, whether it's Novus Ordo or it's the Tridentine. It's
or
really
some of those Eastern, like a Maronite rite. If you've ever been to one of those,
I have down at St. Meinrad. Yeah, I went to one. Really, yeah. And I've been to a Syrian Orthodox divine liturgy too. And yeah, it's not that they're being innovative or creative or self-expressive in a Wild West sort of, you know, anything goes, but rather you can see that they're pouring themselves into the role of priest, and the laity are appropriating their role in the Mass as well.
Yeah.
And the music fits, and the rubrics are being lovingly followed and lived out. And it just, there's just a very big difference versus, I've never experienced this, but the pizza and beer Mass, right? I mean,
right,
something horrible like that.
Right, you know, I've heard
things have gone horribly wrong when you think that's a good idea.
Yeah, performance art Masses, you know, I've heard of clown Masses, you know, where they...
You don't want that on your resume
when
you meet the Lord.
Yeah, not only are they slightly irreverent, but once again, the role you're pouring yourself over to, the role you're submitting yourself to is not the role of priest or liturgist or laity. It's the role of clown, and something very wrong with that. So you know, the form is something that you have to submit yourself to, and you have to pour yourself into, whether you're appreciating it. And you know, with the Mass, there's nobody that's there just as a spectator. I mean, we don't go to Mass just to watch Mass being performed. We go to Mass to participate. To be in it. And so, you know, our role of layperson who's praying and praying with the priest and participating in that way is crucial. And you know, how well we do that individually and how well we do that as a community of faith, I think very much determines the beauty of that particular Mass.
Mm-hmm. Well, even last night, I was at a book study up at the parish, and where Father Dzinski is leading us through this book. It was the first evening. It's called Return by Kevin Vogt, and it's about how, for fallen away Catholics, how to attract them back. And one of the things that was brought up that I think that ties into this conversation here is that There's a very big difference in terms of disposition between having to go to Mass and wanting to go to Mass.
Yeah.
And so one of the contributing, and there's usually a lot of factors why people fall away from the faith, but it's this, as you were talking about, this idea of being in the Mass and participating in the Mass and not just going through the motions. It's how we ourselves are modeling that for others, that can make that can be opening up, helping open up someone else to the graces of that aesthetic experience. If I'm wildly distracted or disinterested in what's going on at Mass or other liturgies, then that may. And Dr. Adams is sitting next to me, and she's being faithful. I can be distracting, or I can be pulling her off course,
right?
And that's not good for her soul or mine.
Yeah, I think we've all had both experiences. We've had the experience where we go to Mass, and we're just not in the mood. You know, we don't want to be there. We'd rather be somewhere else, but we go into Mass
preoccupied.
Preoccupied.
Sick,
And the priest processes down, and he starts the opening prayers, and there's such a spirit of reverence mm-hmm. and holiness and beauty, not only about him, but by the cantor, by the rest of the congregation, that we get sucked into it. And our mood disappears. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've also had the opposite experience, where we're going to Mass, we're wanting to go to Mass, we're feeling it, we get there, and nothing goes right, and the Mass is done in such a way that you walk out of there just going, why did I even bother coming? So I think we've all had both of those experiences. And you're right, I mean, it's on the one hand, our disposition matters a lot, and it matters a lot to us, mm-hmm. and it matters a lot to the others around us, mm-hmm. but that whole disposition of the community matters immensely too. I mean, Mass really is a community action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Our lack of reverence or our reverence is really impacting the people next to us. And there's a huge difference between the family that brings their kids and the kid has a cold and so we're distracted and then like the Cheerios go everywhere or whatever, the diaper bag falls apart. But that's
someone sneezed on me once in the back of my neck, and that's all I could think about for the rest of the Mass.
Well, there's, really I know, but there's a big difference between
it was distracting.
Yeah, well, yeah, but there's a difference between the distraction of people who are trying to be with Christ and people who are overtly saying, "Okay, I'm going to kind of take over this, and this is going to be about my show." When those things just happen and they happen because we're sick, it's just sort of that's the human condition. Right, Christ is so kind to us. He just knows how frail we are.
When you're in a faithful community mm-hmm. that the community is participating, mm-hmm. those things melt into the woodwork.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing to hear recordings sometimes mm-hmm. of Mass that you were there, you remember it. It was very reverent, very faithful. And then you hear the recording, and you hear all the coughing and the sneezing and the people scratching on the pews, and you hear all that in the background, and you go, I don't remember any of that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something. Oh, sorry. I was just thinking. There's something nice though about when it's not people setting out to hijack the Mass or to it's just being human. There's something about it that's kind of an antidote towards that sort of gourmet, like, I'm looking for the most spiritual experience at Mass ever. How dare you have children? You're ruining my prayer. You know, it's like, that kind of person.
That's a little over-rotating, I think.
I know,
right?
But we've all met that kind of person who's sort of like, they were bound and determined that they were going to have the best experience ever, and that's not,
ruining their Mass.
Yeah.
And I think there's a little bit of that.
Yeah, so
it
it's like, it is supposed to be an experience of the beauty of God, but you're not supposed to be like you said about the dog, piling up treats for yourself. So
and there's a reason we worship in community.
Right.
There's a reason it's a community experience, because you're supposed to give yourself over not just to the aesthetic experience of the Mass, but you're supposed to give yourself over to the body of Christ, to your brothers and sisters mm-hmm. that are gathered with mm-hmm. you there. Talking about that, though, aesthetic experience, this is a way of sort of submitting yourself to something higher than yourself. The highest form of that is the Mass.
Mm-hmm.
But are there other aesthetic experiences that we should be cultivating as communities of Catholics?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's, of course, the things that kind of augment and supplement Mass. I think adoration and benediction is particularly a really beautiful communal way to pray. And then I'm always a big fan of, finding what would be a good feast for our parish to celebrate and have some beautiful liturgy and then a beautiful party after. We can, not every parish is equipped to do a symphony performance, but
some of them are, actually. Yeah.
But you could have a really good feast afterwards with beautiful things to see, like flowers or fireworks or like sparklers for the kids or whatever's safe, You can check it with your pastor.
right.
But, and beautiful things to eat and beautiful music and, or even a dance. My parish does like Virginia Reel or something like that. A big group dance where it's not the awkwardness of having to ask for a partner or whatever.
That's because people don't think of those things as particularly beautiful necessarily, but they are in their way. Having mm-hmm. the form of a communal dance like mm-hmm. that, the Virginia Reel or whatever. There's a form. You're submitting yourself to it.
And people
have
dressed up.
It,
so, it's a beautiful scene. So,
right.
Yeah.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. I want to go to it now.
Yeah.
But, the visual art mm-hmm. at a parish too is mm-hmm. is key. I mean, mm-hmm. A lot of parishes, unfortunately, we've been I think
we're stripped down.
Right, we've been influenced by modernism and the modernist movement in art. So we've stripped our parishes down to bare minimal, you know, minimal structure, and we've gotten rid of the statues. We've gotten rid of the icons, which I think is just a tremendous. It's beyond a shame to
be
honest.
I think we might have bottomed out. I feel like though the plane is starting to gain a little altitude. But guess what though?
We're out of time.
Doggone it! This has been a lot of fun. We've had Dr. Gwen Adams here, fun. The Catholic Cave. Thanks for listening. We're talking about aesthetics, so catch us on the weekends when we broadcast. Catch us on Podbean, our podcast. So anyway, great. Thank you. Thank you all for listening to the Catholic Cave. Tune in next week, and we will thrill and delight you with more Catholic philosophy.
It'll be beautiful.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at catholicradioindy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at catholicradioindy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.
Before the sun rises, and long after it sets. While you're waiting in traffic or winding down from your day, when you need us, we're here. Catholic Radio Indy.